Stop. Let's have a seat, and we're going to have a fun time of sharing and learning and inspiration. Hey, Stephen. Made it all the way down here today.
Yeah, I thought this was pretty cool.
Good, good. Enthusiasm is infectious. Okay, folks, come on up. This will be fun. I'm pretty sure we're going to have a good time of sharing and prayer. Okay, is everyone seated? Okay, come on up. We've got some folks who are hanging out in the soundboard back there, so they're going to make sure that anything that goes wrong will be fixed up before we know it. Welcome, all everyone. Welcome and have a seat. Well, we really are privileged. Pastor Sue mentioned to me about a month or so ago that Jennifer has written a book called The 228 Legacy. And I said, I don't really know what that book's about. It's a new book. And then he shared with me Inheritance Magazine, right? And I said to myself, here I am promoting Inheritance Magazine among us, and I don't even read it myself. And there she is on page 16. She was interviewed by Inheritance Magazine, and there's a little brief blurb about her. And it just got me very excited to know that there is a sister in Christ who is doing her very best to share good news, I guess, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but sharing the good news through the form of a creative art of writing. So today I think we're really, really, and she happened to be coming on up to visit anyway to share about her book, I think in San Leandro yesterday?
San Jose,
okay. Yeah, right. So this is an opportunity for her to and we just thought that this would be a great opportunity to have her with us as well. So have a seat, Jennifer, and what we're going to do is basically do an interview process, because I think this interview is more interesting than just simply having one or two persons do all the talking. Well, actually, that might be what it's going to turn out to be like. and then afterwards, if there's time, I'd like to invite you to share questions. All right. So have a seat. Welcome, everyone. Let's begin with a word of prayer. We are grateful, God, that you have called to us. Your sister in Christ, who is ready to share some very insightful stories, and in her story, in her own life itself is a story to share too. So we're so grateful for her testimony, and we are hoping and looking for signs of your work and your presence through this book and through her life. So as we talk and share and enjoy each other's company, let this be a good time of fellowship, a time where we can really learn and grow from one another. Thank you again for gathering all of us here. In Jesus' name I pray. Okay, well, thank you, Jennifer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The book 228 Legacy, there it is.
There it is.
it's a book that I think that when you first read it, you might get the impression that it's only about the 228 Legacy, but later on we'll talk more about it. But to begin with, could you share a little bit more about your background and, you know, about yourself? What brings you here to the Bay Area?
Okay. Well, we're from LA, so we drove up here. And we have family here. My father-in-law is over there. Say hi. And my mother-in-law, who's videotaping this right now, so we definitely have connections to the Bay Area, and I actually worked here for a little while too, a nonprofit helping some low-income women find jobs. So we did that. So my background is, so my husband's Taiwanese, and family's Taiwanese, obviously, and my parents are Chinese. So my mom is from Hong Kong, and my dad is from Malaysia. So it's been interesting to have that background and kind of be introduced to Taiwanese culture and learn more about and understand more about it as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Sure. in terms of my faith, yeah. or?
Well, not yet. You know,
okay.
We'll get to that. Like about like where you grew up,
okay.
you know, where you study. You
okay,
know.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So the brief recap is I am from California. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Fresno, which is Central California. Mm-hmm. And I studied biology in undergraduate. I went to Cornell on the East Coast, and my major was in biology and society. I also had a concentration in gerontology there as well. And then later on, I went to UCLA and I have my master's in social work. I actually have my license, so I'm a licensed clinical social worker. And I worked with older adults for mm-hmm. a while before writing this book as well.
Are you still in that field right now? Or
I still have my license, so okay. I'm still licensed to practice, but I'm not currently employed. By the company. Uh-huh. I also have two young kids, so I'm raising them.
Yeah.
They're 4 and 6, so yeah. I'm doing that. So that's pretty much my full-time job, and then this writing as well. So 1.5 jobs, I guess.
Well, yes, raising kids is about 1.5 jobs. So and many of us are fully aware of that. But maybe you can say a little bit about your faith journey, and you know, how did you come to know Christ, and you know.
I became saved in my senior year in high school. What happened was, actually it relates a little bit to the message we were talking about mm-hmm. in English service. We were talking about being perfect, right? And in high school, I came to a point where I really wanted to be perfect. I wanted to be the perfect daughter, you know, the perfect sister. I have a brother. And the perfect student. And it was just really hard, but I was doing it for my own will, not knowing Jesus and not relying on his strength. So I think that really wore me down and got me in this rut where I was very confused about who I was and felt like I was living for everybody else's expectations. And what I really was searching for was purpose and what is this meaning in life. And so I started really exploring different religions at the time and studying the texts and talking to friends. And then I really got drawn to Christian faith and just, it resonated, the truth of it resonated with me. I had a lot of friends who invested in me, and I actually ended up having a dream as well where I was able to see Jesus and kind of have that personal touch that he spoke to me, and so that really convinced me to go and really follow him.
Now, was this in Fresno, or?
This was in Fresno, and then okay. later on, when I went to Cornell, I also mm-hmm. was part of InterVarsity, mm-hmm. which yes. was a key, just key point for me as well, because, and then I realized it was not just about, it's not just about knowing God mm-hmm. and getting saved, but also being able to follow Christ and really change my life, like we're mm-hmm. talking about, mm-hmm. really pursuing that profession in Christ because of him.
So when you moved back to Southern Cal, was that how you got in touch with Taiwanese culture? Did you connect with a Taiwanese church?
It was through family. So basically, okay. So I was dating Steve and
at Cornell?
At Cornell. We met in undergrad. We met at InterVarsity.
InterVarsity, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were a part of many different ministries mm-hmm. together. And so I really saw his heart for serving people, and we were at part of what was called the Chicago Urban Plunge, where we do like mm-hmm. a short-term missions in the inner city, and I saw him serving, and that really drew me towards his character and the way that he really loves God. And then we started dating after that, and he introduced me to his family and heard all about his family stories and a deeper understanding of Taiwan, which I didn't really know growing up. You know, I would hear like snippets on the news, but I didn't really fully understand until I was part of the family.
Mm-hmm. And where are you worshiping now?
Yeah. We are worshiping down in Los Angeles at New Song, LA, down there. It's a pretty multicultural church mm-hmm. and with a heart for serving that community and pulling in the diversity that's in LA and connecting the cultures there.
Thank you. There's going to be time for all those of you in the audience to also ask questions, but I'd like to spend a little time talking about your vocation as a writer and what inspired you to actually write the book. But let's start with what were the things, the elements that drew together this desire to write a book like this?
For the writing part, mm-hmm. I've always really wanted to write. I've always been drawn to stories, and even as a child, I would write little stories in my notebooks and have people read them. And it was always something that was within me. And then when I grew up, I felt really drawn to Taiwan, especially when I visited there, and I was able to see just the beautiful land and just the variety, right? You have like these lush places and the mountains and the trees and sparkling water, and all these things impressed upon me. And I think the book came about because I saw that contrast between the land, beautiful land, and then hearing about what happened historically in this kind of dark period of time in Taiwan's history. And then the human element of talking to people who've been through it or heard about it and just how it affects them even now.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not everyone here is really that familiar with what 228 means.
Okay.
Maybe you can just give us some information and...
The brief recap. Yeah. So basically, there's a period in Taiwan where they're transitioning from this 50-year rule, a Japanese rule. And then after World War II, the leadership turns over and it becomes this government that's from Chiang Kai-shek and his followers from the Republic of China, and they move over to Taiwan and they take over. And this is the group, of course, that's been defeated by the Communist Party, and they go over and they take over Taiwan. And after that, there's this couple years that they're starting to rule. It's really a chaotic time. They're having a rough time. There's economic hardships. There's food shortages. It's there's a hard period. And so 228 happens right after this, and it's sort of this. It stems actually from a time when there's a widow, she's trying to make a living during this hard time, and basically they confiscate the goods that she's trying to sell, and they take away her money, and the people there riot, and there's a gunshot that goes into the crowd, and then everyone gets riled up, and they want to, you know, make changes in the country. But, of course, the government at the time doesn't want these changes to be made, and so... There's a period of time when people are, you know, basically are silenced, and there's a long period afterward that stems from the 228 massacre, and it's called the White Terror. It's pretty much like 4 years where people who are speaking out against the government are silenced, they disappear, and they perish under this government.
And my mother is Taiwanese, but my father is from the mainland. Mm. So I grew up not knowing anything about this, primarily because within my own family, this was something that was kept a secret. And it also created tension with the in-laws that I didn't know about until later. So now here I am at Canaan Taiwanese Church, like you, feeling like an outsider, trying to understand the experience of Taiwanese Americans. And maybe some Taiwanese Americans don't even know, but how was it like for you to sort of coming from this perspective as sort of like one of the characters in the book, his name is Jack. Mm-hmm. He made the mistake of saying that all Chinese and Taiwanese are the same. Mm-hmm. How did you, you know, make that transition into the Taiwanese culture and gained, and what are the things that you learned from the most in as you engage the Taiwanese American culture?
Oh, I've been very blessed. My in-laws are great, and mm-hmm. they've been really wonderful sources of knowledge that have been open to me wanting to learn more mm-hmm. things and telling me stories and things like that. So I feel that I've been able to just really get good information for them. I'm really, really blessed to have them. And I think the more that I learn, it's kind of like the more I want to know. So I've been multiple times to Taiwan now, and being able to see the land and like talk to relatives there has been amazing experiences mm-hmm. as well. And then now that I've written the book, I've been able to connect to some of the communities, Taiwanese communities in the different areas, especially in LA where I'm from, and I've been able to talk to them. It's been really neat to see mm-hmm. kind of like the almost like the fellowship that they have as the community embracing their identity. They're able to work together, and they have they share cooking classes, they do like dragon boat and stuff together. It's been really neat to see mm-hmm. kind of the solidarity there.
Fantastic. In fact, I'd like to see if, you know, get at the reasons why you wrote the book. It sounds like your observations inspired you to write. But how does that connect to your faith and your sense of gifting as a writer and maybe why you felt this story was important to share?
For the sense of gifting, I feel like God has always called me. Like I feel like God and even Jesus, I guess, speaks in parables, and stories are a really vital way of teaching. When I learned about these events and the Tutoya massacre, I felt like it's something that needed to be out there. So historically, there's a period of time when not only was this happening, but nobody talked about it. It was taboo to talk about for decades, decades. And then even afterwards, people didn't talk about it because they still felt, you know, emotionally restrained and unable to speak about it. Mm-hmm. So I really thought that this was a story, first, it just needed to be told because nobody has heard about these events. My parents didn't know about it. Friends that I know, some even Taiwanese Americans haven't heard about it. So I thought that was important. And the second piece is I really feel that God has a heart to, you know, bring reconciliation, and that he desires, right, to have nations and all different tongues worship him and come together. And that's the beauty of his plan for humanity. So part of the reason why I wrote the book also was to have a dialogue between, you know, those mainland Chinese and like Taiwanese people, and to be able to at least have a story that's interesting, that pulls people in, so they can start talking to each other and they can have to reconnect, and they can maybe have some reconciliation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, and that's very difficult given the geopolitics of the day, although hopefully things are changing and looking up for the future. Let's talk a little bit about the book. Let me see what I wrote down. And I've already read 2/3 of it, so I haven't caught up to the conclusions about reconciliation. And I'm not going to give any spoilers away. You have to buy the book. But because I'm not aware of the entire ending of the story, I can only share ask some questions that maybe will invite us all to participate. So essentially, three generations of women, Taiwanese women. Grandmother's name is Silk, the daughter's name is Lisa, and the granddaughter's name is Abby. And I noticed that as you wrote about these characters, they don't fit into the Asian American model minority stereotype at all, right? And I'm curious about, well, and maybe you can say more without spoiling it. I mean, they're not affluent. I think daughter Lisa grew up in the 60s and got stoned and took drugs. Well, anyway, tell me more about why did you feel that it was compelling to tell sort of a non-model minority approach to this, to the Taiwanese American story?
That's a really good question, because I know that there are love stories of, you know, many Taiwanese Americans, and they're very much successful and everything, and which is true. What I wanted to do in the story is sort of investigate sort of the trauma that gets passed down from generations. So you have the starting point of Tutoya, and how does that affect, and just to even to see the extreme of how it could affect the generations, to give you more that sense of what kind of emotional turmoil and psychological damage that could occur after something like this. That's part of why I made them different. I think another piece of it is just that there are some readers, I find that they look at it and say, oh, well, I've already heard the story before. So then they're not interested because they feel like it's nothing new, and so they don't even want to invest the time into it. But what I've heard from feedback is people say, wow, this is at least you flip things on its head, and it's really great to kind of see that and to think about people in different ways. I also think it lends more individuality mm-hmm. to the characters. So then you're not thinking of them as, oh, you know, I already have this vision of what happens to this person or how this person is. But now you can see them as, you know, distinct characters and be more involved in what happens in their lives.
Yeah, and they do come across that way. They're not it's not like Amy Tan's three generations of Chinese American families that have become relatively affluent, but there's also this sense that these are three, the grandmother and the mother are single mothers, and they're trying their best to raise their kids, and there's so many different nuances there that I, you know, never thought of when I, especially here at Canaan. Whenever I think about a Canaan family here, it's very different. It's a very different kind of look. Anyway, but thank you. And if you want to say more about that, I don't want to give away the story, but there's another piece that I drew from the story that I think might be useful to hear more about your thoughts. It wasn't strictly about the 228 experience itself. It's really about these three generations of women who live in Southern California, and then the characters who live around them, who are their neighbors or friends, they're all involved with doing something good for someone else. And that is something which I thought was very intriguing. Is there a reason why you wanted to tell stories of how these, like Jack, for example, was able to help a homeless man find a job, and later on he helps to refurbish a park in a inner city neighborhood. So what's behind that? Why do you want to show people doing things that are for their neighbor?
I think part of that is, well, part of it's my social work background. Mm-hmm. I feel like it just seeps in, like I have a heart for social justice. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you can see that in the book. And I think another huge part is just my faith. I feel like God mentions many times, you know, to take care of the widows, to take care of the orphans, to take care of those in need. When Jesus himself comes and ministers to those who are sick, you know, those who are broken. I think my faith really played a part in pulling that out, and I have really a strong desire to bring to light those who are voiceless and those who have needs. And so part of when I wrote it, I think I naturally just tended to say, you know, here are these people who are not really seen in society, and whether it be homeless or the poor, or even in my story, since there are multiple generations, the elderly and people are aging, and some of the thoughts and feelings and experiences that they have as well that are not really highlighted mm-hmm. in the public.
It was very exciting to see that even the elderly could make a difference, yeah. wherever they were. So I was struck by how these characters really wanted to do good for other people. And again, that's something I don't necessarily stereotype Asian Americans for doing, but it's wonderful. Well, I thought it might be good to, if you'd like to read an excerpt or something, how do you feel, guys? You want to hear it a little?
Yeah? Sure. Let me see. I can. Let's see if I can balance everything.
Okay, maybe I should help you. I should have given you my
That's all right. Okay, so this passage is actually at a night market in Taiwan, and each chapter is written by a different perspective of a different generation. So this is actually from the granddaughter Abby's perspective. So I'll start down here. Abby and her family walk up down a block to the bustling night market. Encouraged by a connection to the local girl, she meets this local girl, and you know, they kind of look at each other during this puppet show and are excited that they have friends even in different country. So encouraged by a connection, Abby feels excited. She can't wait to try all the delicacies. Seems like every treat under the sun is sold by these shouting vendors crammed together on an asphalt lot. She cranes her neck, watching some workers create little pancakes, crafted into different shapes, ducks, guns, elephants, and more. Ama sees her interest and pays for a piping hot batch from the cellar. I'm glad you're here to try our Taiwanese treats, her grandmother says. Thank you for asking me to come along. They smile at each other, and Abby takes the pancake. She bites down on the hot goodness of eagerness and feels a pair of eyes on her. It's the same girl from the puppet show. Abby grins at her and passes over a fresh pancake shaped like a cat. The girl takes a big bite and mumbles something with her mouth full. Abby thinks she's saying thank you, Mikiki, Abby says in Taiwanese. And the girl stops eating and steps back a little. Abby repeats the words, you're welcome. The girl almost spits out the dough at Abby. Abby turns to her grandmother. Did I say it wrong? She asks. No, you said it perfectly fine. The girl grew up under the KMT rule. She probably never got taught Taiwanese and understands only Mandarin. Ama scuttles Abby away from the girl, who's now pointing in their direction and laughing. A fruit vendor, an older gentleman with juice-stained hands, blocks her way. For you, miss, he says in Taiwanese. He hands Abby a bell-shaped fruit. It's a deep red, and its waxed skin reminds her of a cross between an apple and a pear. She bites down, enjoying the crispness combined with a rich juiciness which floods her mouth. She stops as she discovers the middle, a flavorless weave containing a hard seed. She feels like this bell fruit, looking Taiwanese on the outside, but with a woven facade hiding the core of her inner Taiwanese-American dual self.
Thank you. Why did you pick that one?
I picked that one because I felt like it's got, you know, key insights in different things. So one thing it looks at, you know, the Taiwanese night market and the food culture. And then another is the perspective of this younger generation who's getting exposed to her culture and trying to figure out what that means in her life and struggling with that. And then third, about the citizens in Taiwan really being, well, like the older citizens being generous and just trying to give and to help her to find her place and to find her identity and to give her a taste of kind of what the people, the hospitality of the people of that country is like.
Yeah, and it makes me want to go to Taiwan.
You should go.
I haven't been there since I was born. but you know, the character that the grandmother Silk, it makes this chapter seems to have shown that she was. Was this her first time back to Taiwan after a long time? That was the impression I got, that she had not gone back.
Yeah, she hadn't gone back.
Because then when she went back to visit her the place where she met her husband, it seemed to have been a letdown. Like all the things that she remembered about her past changed so much. So I think maybe in some ways the metaphor I'm thinking getting at is what happens for us, especially as history is changing and the next generation of Taiwanese Americans and Taiwanese are growing up. What in the past is fading. What do you think is the hope for the future? If people look to the past and don't want to get stuck in it, but they also know that it's something that's fading away. What hope do you would you like to offer?
Well, I would like to. I mean, my hope is that there is that connection between older and younger generations. And I think it is unfortunate when you have newer generations and they don't really know about the past and they don't remember it. So that's why I think it's important, and it's in my book too, that the generations talk to each other and there's like an openness there and even a transparency to say, you know, this is what happened. This is what I'm going to tell you about, and that hopefully they'll be able to learn something about that. And I think it's freeing in both ways. I mean, it's helpful for the younger generations, but also for older generations. I also did a gerontology project when I was at Cornell, and we would go and interview older adults, and we would actually take down their life stories and their key moments in their lives, and just being able to, I think, share what were the significant moments, it brought so much joy to them that they were able to impart what they had lived through. And I think it was really healing and hopeful for them. And then for me, as the younger generation, I was able to learn so much. And I thought, well, if anyone just went up and, you know, spent time with people of different generations and they were able to talk and take in their stories and their words, I think it would be so beneficial to both the generations. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that leads me to another question. I'm sorry, I'm sort of off track here, but in our church, I've noticed that, and maybe it's not just our church, but a lot of folks I know who are in their 20s are not very comfortable relating to people who are outside of their particular life stage. So, you know, I hear stories of college students who come back from college, they come back up here, and they don't. And there may be young adults who are just a few years older than they are, but they still don't feel comfortable connecting, and vice versa. So what kind of practical advice would you give to those of us? Now, I'm older now, but But for anyone who's younger and wants to learn how to relate to someone who's not in your age group, someone older, besides learning the language, but I mean, what kind of advice which can you give to helping people to overcome the barriers between life stages?
I think that's really hard. I see it a lot of times, and even at our church, we have two kids. So there's the families, and then there are the singles. And I think that it's hard because we think, oh, we're in a certain life stage, mm-hmm. and there's certain, you know, things that are going on that are not the same as these other people. And it's hard to think beyond that. What I find has been helpful, at least for me, and this is something I'm still learning too, is mm-hmm. that when we have events at New Song, you know, we have kind of mixer events where we deliberately put together people, you know, who have different life stages in the same room to have some sort of connection so that they can share and talk to each other. And once you actually take that first step of saying hi and talking to them, you understand that there's a lot more that's mm-hmm. similar. And then particularly, I think, within the Christian community, it's like, well, you already know that you have this bond that's already there from Jesus. So it actually is there's less of a barrier because you already know that, okay, this is already my brother and sister, basically my family in Christ. And so maybe you can connect on that level. You can start off at that level, and then it, you know, expands later on to all other things that you can share about and talk about.
Thank you. Hopefully we all take that advice to heart. It's not easy, I know. But before I open the floor for questions from the audience or discussions, I'd like to have one final question. Is how have people responded to your book and what have you heard? And
Yeah, it's been amazing, the different responses that I've had. So I have responses from the Taiwanese community who say, oh, you know, I'm so glad that someone has written a book about this, that it's out there, that I can talk, and that I can talk to my family. I have people who have experienced or have family members who have experienced tutuwei or the period afterward, and they say, oh, you know, wow, it's great to know that, you know, other people will see where I'm coming from, or even if I can't talk about it, there's something out there. And people who say that, oh, I'm glad you kind of captured what happened in my family or the emotions mm-hmm. that happened within my family. And then I have other Taiwanese Americans or Asian Americans who don't really know about it. So they'll say, wow, I've never heard about this before, ever. Nobody has told me about this. It's kind of interesting to learn like more about my culture, or if they're Asian American, to learn more about a different culture, but yet still relate and say, you know what? I understand these issues of immigration and the kind of gap between the generations of Asian Americans, and it's nice to have that. Then, of course, the other people who aren't Asian American, they say, oh, this is, you know, a great story, and I'll read the story because it has these human elements. I'm drawn to the idea of, you know, following this family on their journey. But in the process, then they start learning more about a different culture and a different history, and it makes them that little more open to, you know, I want to understand things now and kind of see things and maybe have a different awareness of where Taiwan is, like mm-hmm. who Taiwanese people are, because I feel like a lot of people are still not too sure, like, you know, oh, I hear about Taiwan, but I'm not sure, you know, where is it, and what is this culture like? And I don't know if you read that part in the book, but there's a part at the end. This won't really, it's not really a spoiler. It's
okay.
Not really, okay, cover your ears. And then, you know, Abby says, oh, you know, I want to research about Taiwan. And they're like, oh yeah, Thailand, right. I know all about it. So, you know, I think people get that mixed up. And so it's good to have some awareness.
Yes, people should know that Taiwan is the heart of Asia. Thank you very much. And would anyone like to ask a question? Okay, go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah, I'm a Taiwanese. I moved here 4 years ago. But before that, I lived in Taiwan for all 13 years of my life. And, you know, my family has living under the white terror and all that. So yeah, I just for my family, I just want to say thank you so much for trying to put it out there, because I have been hearing about this event from my family so much, and I know like all you say is very true, that there's so much emotional turmoil and hatred in Taiwan. So yeah, I just want to thank you so much for putting this out there and for trying to speak people and trying to bring this reconciliation. So I just want to say thank you so much.
You're welcome very much. I mean, I continue to be inspired by people who share their stories and have gone through those periods of time. I mean, I'm really honored that they're able to respond to my book as well. And I have the utmost respect for people who've gone through that.
Thank you. Stephen.
Can you talk more about the process of doing research to like find historical context as well as like maybe books specifically on 228 that you particularly thought were good sources?
Okay. I think historical research, it takes many different forms. So for me, it was being able to talk to people, so, you know, talking to family and those sources and pulling that in. And then the second stream was, you know, official documents. So thankfully now that there are things in English that I can read, so, you know, and they even have stuff online. You can actually, if you go to my website, jenniferjchow.com. Yeah, it's on here.
No relation.
So, it actually has a part, it might be under About Books. It talks a little bit about a couple of documents that I got online. There's a report on it, and then there's also if there's promotive betrayed, yeah.
And then
yes.
So what's the promotive betrayed?
That is not the movie, but the movie was inspired by that,
right?
Because that actually is from, it's a actually a document from a U.S. diplomat who was there during the World War II period in Taiwan. And he called it Formosa Betrayed, and it's like his eyewitness accounts. And he also pulls in some other sources about what happens during that time. But then later on, of course, the movie gets made, and there's, I mean, it sort of references that historical period, but it's also about, you know, professors, and I don't know if you guys have watched it, so I don't want to give away the, yeah.
Thank you.
So, did I help you? Sorry.
Yeah.
I believe Sabrina has a question. Yeah.
Generation is not originally from Taiwan. I wonder how much information, official information, that you can get your hands on, and how are the officials in Taiwan, how are their attitudes towards providing you those information? Are they still willingly providing, or are they still elusive? I know I came from that, just, you know, probably 1960s. Everything was under the rug. We are not allowed to talk about it in our family. Whenever somebody mentioned in our family, my father would hush, hush, don't talk about it, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know, because I hear this, I hear that, I hear conflicting information. So I would just wonder how much can you verify the fact, historical fact.
Right. That's a good question. I think that I mean, of course, okay, let's say there's creative license in the story as well, but I did try to get the emotions, and I tried to pull in the documents. And when I was visiting Taiwan, thankfully, that there are, you know, there are monuments now, there are museums that are dedicated to what has happened. So I think there's a lot more openness now. So I'm really glad to see that. And like I said, there's also online stuff as well that you can access, which is nice to have there. So I feel like there's more information out there. I mean, I haven't talked to the president or anything in Taiwan, so I'm not sure exactly the official stance on things. But there is more effort to make things known and to have it out there for the public. I know for a lot of years that wasn't the case, and I went to the National Museum of Taiwan Literature there, and they didn't have there was parts of decades where, you know, you couldn't see anything. There was nothing written about it, right? And nobody knew anything about it. But nowadays, I feel like there's at least monuments and museums and things dedicated to it.
Yeah. I think the verification, if I can just throw something in, to verify something is very difficult, especially if a government doesn't want certain truths. And this is true for almost every government. So the important thing is to allow voices to speak out. Even if it's not completely accurate, if there are many voices out there, it allows for a diversity of perspectives, and in the process, maybe the truth gets told. But it's good. It's a good question. And as a historian, I'm an advocate for more different voices.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to add something to you real quick with that. I mean, it's true what you're saying. I was thinking, I was looking up like different photos from that time period, and there's nothing. Mm-hmm. Everything got destroyed, right? Yeah. That, or maybe, I guess, someone could be hiding it really well, you know, but there's only very few. Sorry.
You talked earlier about during graduate school, or regret, I'm not sure, but you're talking about, like, being in Cornell, taking the major events of these older retired people, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
Are there like archives of like where that's published normally, and then do you publish like certain stuff for your records, or it's probably just your personal?
The ones I have are personal notes. But for that was a specific project at Cornell, they actually have have like a gerontology center and program there. So I'm not sure how they were gonna use those life stories. But
they're not public.
I don't think they're public at this point, but it's kind of interesting. It would be interesting to read.
I think other scholars could probably access that.
Yeah.
Actually, it'd be interesting that on NPR, they did a huge project on intergenerational stories being told, and it's archived in the Library of Congress. So you can get huge trove in this huge diversity.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, I think it's kind of, it'll be harder to look it up unless you are in the academy. And which reminds me that Carolyn Shen, who wrote A Sociological Study of Taiwanese American Communities, she's currently at Stanford. If you want me to, I can try to get her to come and do another one of these.
Yeah.
She can give you more academic information. Okay, all right, we'll see. Ethan?
So the problem is that you don't really speak Chinese or Taiwanese, right? But if you do, there's actually a lot of first-hand accounts because it's not that far ago, so people are still alive. Actually, to be honest, if you go downstairs to a Taiwanese service right now, there's probably people who have come through it. Right,
stay a while longer. Vincent, and then,
Okay, so 228 refers to February 28th?
Yes, 1947.
So can you, it sounds like it's a whole drawn-out process, but did something happen on that day?
There's a big massacre on that day. The day before was when the widow's, you know, savings got taken, and then the day after is February 28th, and then they have this, you know, basically, so they were rebelling, and basically that there was a big massacre, right? And then after that, then they ended up sending more troops in to sort of govern the area, right, and to take away any opposition. But it was all, I mean, later it was all, you know, everywhere in that.
You first.
I am working on multiple stories at this time, so I'm trying to figure out. I'm in the process of like editing one and writing another and revise, or and then sending a finished one to some first readers to see their responses. So I'm kind of working in, you know, a lot of different stories, and we're going to see which one comes up first. I think that's really true. I think it's really hard to kind of provide its, you know, information down to the next generation. I think part of it is, it's like, you know, where do I even start from? It's knowing where to start from. And I'm not sure about in your case, but I do have a friend who, she actually read the book, and she also was actually similarly raised with these three generations with generations of single mothers. And what happened with her is she actually had a document, and they were like, all the questions I want to ask of my grandmother. And she said, you know, when you have time, can you just write down the answers to these questions? Because I've always wanted to know about your life and your experience. But it was hard for them to actually verbally talk about it. And so she gave it to her grandmother, and she didn't think her grandmother even looked at it. And sadly, her grandmother ended up passing away. And so she thought that nothing ever came out of it. But later on, they were actually going through her belongings, and she pulled out this document, and was pretty much all filled with these answers to the questions that she had on her heart. So I think there are ways that can happen, whether it's written or verbally. So it's, I mean, it's trying to find that way that will work for your family. I don't know. Good books. I don't know any resources offhand for intergenerational communication. I don't know if you guys have anything.
I don't know of any. I think it's really up to the community to take care of that. So I was thinking about your question, and then before Nelson asked, because I think one of the hardest things for younger generation who were raised here in this country to think about is, how is this relevant to their life? Because it was in the past, things in Taiwan have changed. So for them to understand how to connect those experiences with who they are now and as they look to the future is probably the most challenging thing. So keeping records would help, but I think it takes a lot more effort.
Yeah.
But before you go, Nelson had a question.
Probably not an overly argumentative question.
But that's okay, Nelson. You're good at that.
As you were doing research for this book, do you think it affected your view, and do you think it should affect your reader's view on such things in the United States as, say, the Occupy movement, or what's going on in Ukraine and Venezuela right now?
Wow.
He wants you to broaden into the geopolitical commentary.
Pass, no.
That's what we can learn from Taiwan.
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, I hope that when you read it, or you read any literature or anything that kind of pulls in information and makes you aware of things, that you go out there and you kind of use your more, you know, you have your mind open, so that you're not kind of living in your bubble and just thinking about your own life, but you think about the larger issues as well. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm hoping that that the mindset is there, right, to be more perceptive about what's going on, to analyze things, and to kind of think, you know, larger community versus like individual life.
Betty, and then when Betty, Wendy, and Eric, and then I think we might have called it quits.
I was very intrigued with your suggestion of writing a big long list of questions that you're giving it to your grandparents to write answers to, and I thought that was really I'm intrigued, but also it really appealed to me in a sense that, you know, they're writing, they're answering the questions in a non-intimidating, very comfortable environment, and you know, and then you can read it or have someone else translate it to you at your leisure and later on. But the problem is, I think as a younger generation, if you don't understand the historical context, you can't even come up with a list of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Other than just say, how old were you when you were born? I mean, what year were you born, and where?
Mm-hmm.
What's your hometown? I mean, those kind of stuff. But you know, to ask more in depth and insightful questions, you have to know your history and say, well, if this event happened here, how did it affect your life, and how did your family respond, or how did it affect the family? You know, that kind of stuff. So I think as a younger generation, that sort of gives us more motivation to learn more history, you know, whether it be world history or the local regional history, so that you can be able to ask more insightful and thoughtful questions and see how the world events or the regional events affect people's individual lives, right?
Mm-hmm. That's so true. And I think that there needs to be awareness. I was going to add just one thing, which was this kind of ties in what you were talking about, like being aware, is that I know that, so there's a 228 Memorial event here, but then there's one in LA, and I know for that event, they actually did pull in like the firsthand eyewitness accounts, and my hope is that people would attend those sort of like cultural events and then actually get more understanding of the history as well and be able to have those, you know, more specific questions. And another offshoot is I remember that in school I had to do like interviews with my parents, and the teachers would do actually like specific questions to give me a better sense of what to ask so that I could pull more from their life stories as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's 12:25, so if Wendy and Eric can just go quickly, if we can't get to finishing to answer your questions, we can go downstairs and you can talk one-on-one at the book signing. Yeah. There's a lot of violence.
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
Probably, I would say, I mean, not young kids, not like elementary. I would say probably high school and up would be my recommendation. Yeah.
Yeah. Eric, can you go ahead? And
My book is not, doesn't go into the dark, gory details, and I mean, there's some history in it, but it's really more the sense of, you know, what this event, how would it affect a family, how does it pass on the trauma from the generation, so it's more about that human context of it, as opposed to like, these are the things that happened, and, you know, these are the dark conditions.
It's largely based in Los Angeles.
Yes, and it's American-based, so.
That's right. Well, our time is up for now, and Jennifer will be autographing books downstairs, and if you want to talk to her more directly, that would be a great time. Hopefully we can provide you a meal as well, but we'll see. We got folks on that.
Yeah, feel free to come downstairs, and as I say, it's on sale, a discounted rate downstairs.
Yes.
And also, I have an e-newsletter that I send out about my news, and it has like kind of snippets about Taiwan, and I'm doing this like Taiwan A to Z thing on it, so you can have little sites in Taiwan by alphabet. Sorry.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, for
thank you for having me.
Oh, wow. That was fun.